Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Associate Professor Kaelin Davenport, Senior Lecturer in Roman History at Macquarie University and Humboldt Research Fellow at Goethe University in Frankfurt, Germany. This is episode CLXVIII, The Battle of Arbutus. The Goths are leaving Roman territory, and while they successfully sacked some Roman cities, there have been no lasting damage to the provinces. But the same can't be said for the reputation of the emperor. Decius rides with his troops to confront them in battle, becoming the first Roman emperor to die at the hands of a foreign enemy. Here's Kaelin Davenport.
There's been a major crisis in the Balkans. Decius has been defeated and had to retreat back to Novi on the Danube, and the city of Philippopolis has fallen to the Goths, and the Greeks are worried that the Goths are going to spread further into their own territory, looting and pillaging as they go. This appears to have been an opportunity for a senator in Rome with the name of Iulius Valens Licinianus to take advantage of Decius' absence in the Balkans and the recent failures. The news of these defeats and the loss of Philippopolis will have certainly made it to Rome. So Valens declares himself emperor. This is mentioned in Aurelius Victor, as well as the epitome De Caesaribus, that shortened version, Aurelius Victor. But it also appears in a letter of a contemporary, the Bishop Cyprian of Carthage, who you might remember provides really important information about the Christian reaction to Decius's edict of sacrifice.
Is this a sort of usurpation that is well received, though? Because I think that Decius was one of the Senate's own from memory.
Decius is a senator. He's had long experience as a provincial governor under the Severans, under Maximinus, may have been prefect of the city under Philip. But what we find in the third century is that emperors are only as good as their most recent victory or as bad as their most recent defeat. So it is interesting that there's actually usurpation in Rome, because normally these things happen on the frontiers where someone with an army says, actually, I can do a better job. We don't know what Valens said his qualifications were, but he certainly decided to take advantage of this instability. It's interesting that Cyprian puts a twist on Valens' usurpation. He says that when Decius heard about it, all the way over in Moesia Inferior, he received the news with greater forbearance than the fact that a new bishop had been appointed in Rome. So if you remember, the Bishop of Rome had actually died earlier in the year, either in prison or had been executed because he did not follow the terms of the edict of sacrifice. And then in the middle of the year, a new bishop is appointed. So Cyprian says, you know, he was angry at the fact that there was a new bishop than the fact that there was a challenge to his regime.
Yeah, I think that's Cyprian kind of, you know, tilting his hand a bit there as to what matters to him.
Exactly. I think Decius would have been very concerned about the usurpation. Now, we don't know what happens. It doesn't last long. Valens is killed. I'm presuming this is because the troops left in Rome, if there are Praetorians still there, a detachment of Praetorians. At this time, the emperor often took large parts of the Praetorian Guard on campaign with him, but certainly there would have been some left in Rome because his wife is there, Herennia Etruscilla, as well as his younger son, Hostilianus. And we know that Hostilianus was made Caesar by September at the latest that year. So this may be in reaction to the usurpation of Valens. And Decius wanted to emphasize, you know, there's a member of my family in the city. He has a title of Caesar. He's my representative.
So while all of this is going on in the city of Rome, what is Decius doing to deal with the problem of the Goths who are still in Roman territory, causing more trouble than ever?
He doesn't make a move again until early 251, probably in the spring of that year. During this period, he's been stationed in Moesia. I mean, this is probably because it's very dangerous to campaign in winter. You don't want to be taking large groups of troops, unless you have to, around hilly mountainous territory in the winter. This is almost certainly the consideration of the Goths themselves, that if they're going to return back to their own land, if they're going to cross the Hymas Mountains, they're not going to do that in the winter. So we know, according to one of the new fragments discovered in Vienna, that after their raiding in Thrace and Moesia, the Goths do decide to head north, to go back to their own territory with the booty that they have taken, as well as the Romans that they have enslaved.
So this new fragment that was found, did that add to the knowledge substantially of what's going on during this period of Decius's reign?
Oh, yes, massively. So there have actually been several pages which have been discovered in a manuscript. So 8 pages bear what's called a palimpsest. So that means there are 2 texts. A Christian text has been written on top, in this case, a Christian legal text. So they reused a manuscript of Dexippus. And the scholars in Vienna, Jana Gruskova and Gunther Martin, have been using modern imaging technology to read the text of Dexippus, which lies under the Christian text. So this is really important. It's really transforming our knowledge of events in the mid-third century. So if we recorded these podcasts 10 years ago, the picture would have looked quite different, for example, particularly in our knowledge of what the Goths are doing, also the dating. So it used to be thought that the loss of Philippopolis happened in 251 rather than 250, but because of the chronology events, 250 is clearly the correct date.
So what details then does the fragment give us about the Roman response to Philippopolis being taken?
So the Romans and Goths both waited until the spring of 251 to start moving again. It'd be very dangerous to move or to try and join battle over the winter, especially in cold mountainous terrain. So Decius spent the winter gathering troops. Dexippus says that he brought together some 80,000 soldiers, which is a hugely unrealistic number, given that would be probably about 1/5 of the Roman army at the time. It's probably more like about 20,000. And he's waiting there for the Goths, who at some point are going to cross the Danube back into their own territory. So this is what happens in early 251. We know that they leave Philippopolis. Giordano says they leave laden with spoils. And we also know from Dexippus that they have enslaved people of Thrace. So the first wave of Goths moving forwards, moving northwards, was led by Ostrogotha, and it seems that Niva, the king, was following him with the second band. The new fragment tells us that there were some problems with the Roman auxiliary forces. And I quote from the translation of Jana Gruskova and Gunther Martin, Decius was concerned about the wrongdoing of the auxiliary troops and the capture of Philippopolis. And when the army was gathered, about 80,000 men, he wanted to renew the war if he could, as he had thought the situation was favourable to him, even though he had lost the auxiliary force, but also to liberate the Thracian captives and to prevent them from crossing to the other side. Now, this is really interesting. There's been some problem with the auxiliary forces. You know, did they defect the Goths? Did they ally with them? Did they disgrace themselves in battle? We don't know, because that's where the fragment opens. But it shows that certainly Decius is having problems on his own side.
That could have been part of the massive troop loss that he had in the recent Gothic encounter. Perhaps.
Yes, it could have been at the loss at Beroea, or it could have been something to do with betrayal in Philippopolis. Presumably, the governor of Thrace, Priscus, had auxiliary troops with him. There was no legion stationed in Thrace, but there certainly were auxiliaries. So it's nice the new fragment sort of sheds a bit of light on these problems.
What I don't entirely get about this is that he doesn't seem to be in a position to confront the Goths. He doesn't seem like he's got his troops under control or lined up enough to pose a threat, and yet he's still determined to do that even though the Goths are leaving.
Yes, I mean, the idea is that he doesn't want to just let them cross back over the Danube without some kind of retaliation. But also, Dixippus clearly states he wants to free the Roman captives, so he doesn't want them to be led into slavery in Gothic territory.
All right, so what does he do then?
So according to Dixippus, he gives a speech to his troops before they join battle with Ostrogotha. And he says, I quote, "Men, I wish the military force and all the provincial territory were in a good condition and not humiliated by the enemy. But since the incidents of human life bring manifold sufferings, for such is the fate of mortals, it is the duty of prudent men to accept what happens and not to lose their spirit, nor become weak. Distressed by the mishap in that plain or by the capture of the Thracians, in case any of you has been disheartened by these things. For each of these two misfortunes offers arguments against your discouragement. The former was brought about by the treachery of the scouts rather than by the deficiency of ours, and the Thracian town they took by ambushes rather than through prowess, having failed in their attacks." The manuscript breaks off there. So this is really interesting. So Decius is saying, you know, take heart. I wish that, you know, we hadn't had these terrible losses. But he says, actually, this wasn't our fault. So the mishap in the plain, which is the major disaster at Beroea or Augusta Traiana, he says, you know, that was because the treachery of the scouts, we'd been betrayed. It wasn't our deficiency. And the Thracian town that is Philippopolis, that was betrayed, you know, they didn't take it through their military prowess. So he's saying they're not really great fighters. They've just been very, very lucky so far.
It's a decent argument, I think. They've had luck, we've had bad luck. We can still take them.
Yeah, and it's certainly something you can imagine a commander saying at this point, you know, when you've had these setbacks and you want to rally your troops. As I said, I find it completely implausible that he managed to get 80,000 men together, especially since there'd been some sort of issue with the auxiliaries. About 20,000 is more likely. But we are preparing now for a major confrontation. And it's actually not going to be between Decius and Ostrogotha. We're not quite sure what happens, whether he's involved or not. But the sources for the battle that's coming up place Neva as the main leader.
So where does this battle take place then?
Yeah, so this is the Battle of Abritus in Moesia Inferior. It's near Razgrad in modern-day Bulgaria. Now, we know the battle took place in the first half of June of 251, so it's in the heat of summer. We know this because Decius's death has been announced in Rome sometime between the 9th and the 24th of June.
Okay, that was spoilers.
Oh, I'm so sorry. But...
no, it's fine. So we're told that the Romans have about 80,000 troops on their side, if we are to believe Dexippius. And so they're led by Decius in person?
Yes, by Decius. His eldest son, Herennius Etruscus, is also there. And the governor of Moesia Inferior, the senator Trebonianus Gallus. It's a major defeat for the Romans. Decius and Herennius Etruscus both die in the battle. We're told this is because of the way in which the Goths arrange their forces. So our best source for this is Zosimus, who is writing in the 6th century, but depends on the Greek tradition, which goes all the way back to Dexippus. We don't have Dexippus's own account of the battle. And he says that the Goths divided their forces into three parts. Decius manages to defeat the first two Gothic columns. The third lies behind marshland. Decius heroically leads his troops into the marsh and is never seen again.
How big a loss was this for the Romans? Do we get a sense of that?
Yes, it was a major catastrophe. Not only when we don't have numbers killed, unfortunately, because we don't have Dexippus, but it was certainly a military disaster. Not only Decius, but also his son. and large amounts of Roman booty seems to have been captured. We know this because of the amount of gold which is found in a Gothic territory about this time. It has been argued by Alexander Berscher in an article in Numismatic Chronicle that the entire Roman treasury was captured after the battle. I don't believe that myself. Certainly they had substantial money to pay troops with them, but I don't think they would have taken the entire treasury with them on campaign. I can't accept that interpretation. It's interesting that there are different versions of how Herennius Etruscus and Decius died. There are some sources which suggest that Herennius Etruscus died before the Battle of Abratus. So he actually died in an earlier confrontation. This is what Giordane says, whereas Aurelius Victor has them die in the same battle. Whatever happens, Herennius Etruscus dies first, and then Decius. And there's this tradition that Decius is not affected by the death of his son. The idea that, you know, it's just one loss and the fight needs to continue. So I'll just
got a quote to that effect, don't we?
Yes, yes. I was going to read a quotation here from Giordane's Getica. This is chapter 103. In the battle that followed, they quickly pierced the son of Decius with an arrow and cruelly slew him. The father saw this, and although he is said to have exclaimed to cheer the hearts of his soldiers, "Let no one mourn, the death of one soldier is not a great loss to the Republic," he was unable to endure it because of his love for his son. And then Giordanes has him joining battle because he wants to die or wants vengeance at Abratus.
I can't say I really buy that one, because while it's noble saying that your son is the same as any soldier, that's essentially an emperor who has died.
Exactly. It's pretty clear that shortly before the battle, at some point, he was made Augustus as well, Herennius Etruscus. Mm. But this is part of the tradition. We also find a similar story in Aurelius Victor, chapter 29, where he talks about the Decii, so both Decius and his son. He says, and I quote, "But very many report the death of the Decii were honourable, that in fact the son had fallen in battle while pressing an attack too boldly, that the father, however, while his dejected soldiers were saying many things to console the emperor, had strenuously asserted that the loss of one soldier seemed to him too little to matter, and so he resumed the war and died in a similar manner while fighting vigorously." So there's this idea that he's able to overcome it and die heroically himself. So in the mainstream Roman tradition, it's a heroic act on the part of the emperor. Now, the reason for this is probably the emperor's name. So there's a general of early Republic or Middle Republic called Publius Decius Mus, Decius the Mouse. And yes, I know.
That's a good one.
Yes. So he in 340 died in battle through the act of devotio. So this is that he vowed to the gods that he would exchange his life for a Roman victory. So there's this great Decius of the Republic who sacrificed himself in battle, and Decius the emperor is being compared to him in the Roman tradition there.
Wow, no pressure. So I'm kind of interested in what the Christian sources might say about this event and this death, considering they weren't the biggest fans of Decius.
Yes, well, this is a moment for celebration in the Christian sources. This is what a persecutor deserves. So Lactantius, who's a Christian author writing in the early 4th century AD, wrote a work called De Mortibus Persecutorum, in Latin, On the Death of the Persecutors, in English. And it's mainly about the tetrarchs and all the horrible deaths they suffered. But in the early chapters, he does go through earlier emperors who are supposed to have been persecutors, such as Nero and Decius. And Lactantius in chapter 4 says that Decius is an accursed wild beast who had appeared to afflict the church. I'll go on to quote, "It seems as if he had been raised to sovereign eminence, at once to rage against God and at once to fall. For having undertaken an expedition against the Carpi," he gets some of the facts wrong, "who had possessed themselves of Dacia and Moesia, he was suddenly surrounded by the barbarians and slain together with a great part of his army. He could not be honoured with the rites of burial, but stripped and naked, he lay to be devoured by wild beasts and birds, a fit end for the enemy of God."
Wow. Okay. A bit of retribution there in that.
Yes. Now, we know, of course, that Decius and Herennius Etruscus's bodies were not found. So this is wonderful Christian imagining of what happened to someone who dared to persecute the Christians.
So you say that their bodies were never found. So the broad strokes of this is the Goths won this battle, but I imagine continue back to their own territory, greater victors than before. And Decius and his sons are the first Roman emperors that we know of to officially fall to an enemy combatant. Is that about right?
Yeah, so the Persians claimed that Gordian III fell in battle, but there is also the other tradition that he was betrayed by Philip after the battle, so we're not quite sure. But certainly the loss of both Decius and Herennius Etruscus in battle together was a major blow to the Romans.
And how big a defeat was this? This is on the scale of kind of Teutoburg Forest level of defeat, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, like, certainly if you believe there were 80,000, which I don't, that would be terrible. But certainly, yes, there would have been several legions involved in this battle from the Balkan frontier. So, you know, this is the sort of thing which is going to send shockwaves through Rome.
And while we'll wade into this into the next episode, just broadly, what is the fallout of this event?
The governor of Moesia Inferior, Trebonianus Gallus, who is there on the scene, is acclaimed emperor by the troops to take control of the situation. But, of course, we still have, back in Rome, Decius' wife, Herennia Etruscilla, and his younger son, Hostilianus, who is a Caesar. So we'll have to wait and see what Gallus does about them. If we look back at Decius' reign at emperor, it's a short reign. He's acclaimed after the death of Philip in September, October of 249. He's dead by June of 251. He is someone who plans to have a dynasty, to have both of his sons of imperial rank. He has a vision for the empire. The idea of the Edict of Sacrifice is that if you bring everyone together to sacrifice the gods, that they will support Rome as well as Decius himself. And he has an excellent reputation as a military leader. He does a lot in a short time. Yes, there are some setbacks, but, you know, he manages to expel the Carpi from Dacia, and he is there on the scene tackling the Gothic crisis. It's a story of untapped potential, certainly.
That was Associate Professor Kaelin Davenport, Senior Lecturer in Roman History at Macquarie University, and Humboldt Research Fellow at Goethe University in Frankfurt, Germany, and you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your local friendly neighbourhood podcatching service. Please leave a review, they are always very appreciated. You can like the Emperors of Rome on our Facebook page, or you can follow us both on Twitter. Kaelin is at Dr. C. Davenport, I am at Nightlight Guy, and the podcast is at Rome Podcast. That's it today for Emperors of Rome. In the next episode, we look at the reign of Trebonianus Gallus. But until then, I'm Matt Smith, you've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.